You're listening to a Bucks Plus audio production on the Bucks Plus Network.
Your weekly pulse on the Milwaukee Bucks, straight from a Bucks legend. This is Here District with Marcus Johnson, alongside his son and 1995 NCAA champion, Chris. Here's MJ.
All right, everybody. This is the captain of this vessel. I'm Marcus, my son Chris, my first mate. And man, we are honored. High on the hogs. We are honored to have, really to have my former teammate, Hall of Famer. I guess I could say maybe, he probably wouldn't agree with this, Chris, but I could say maybe the second greatest two-way player in the history of the NBA.
Behind MJ? Behind MJ only?
He may not accept that. Sidney Moncrief, man, well, how do you feel about that, man?
Marcus, I accept that. With you open arms. Yes.
Okay. Yes.
Okay. Someone else can have me like 10 or 11, 12, 13, 14.
No. Well, see, someone else didn't have the privilege of playing with you in Milwaukee for whatever it was. We were together for 5 years, 6 years, whatever it was. And you were just a quick story, Chris, consummate teammate. As we were going to practice, I would always see Sidney veer off to the side at the Mecca in Milwaukee, the old Mecca, seats about 10,000 plus people.
Yes,
and he would go into this little dusty side room.
Uh-huh.
So I'm like, what the hell Sidney got going on in there? You know, what is this all about? So one day I said, I'm going to find out. And so we're headed into practice, me, Sidney, Junior Bridgman, Harvey Ketchens, Paul Pressey, the whole crew. And Sidney veers off to the side to go into the little musty, dusty side room. And I kind of sneak and follow him without him knowing it.
He goes
in the room, shuts the door. So I kind of listen. I don't hear a whole lot going on, some clanging, a little bit of clanging. So I open the door quickly, expecting to kind of surprise him. and he's got a makeshift bench press that the team, I guess, had got for him in this little side room. And he's bench pressing.
What year is this, MJ?
Probably, that what's it, 80?
Probably 81, 82, maybe.
Okay.
Yeah,
okay.
81, 82. I mean, so you kind of, I mean, how did you get into weightlifting? I mean, what was the deal with that? What was the story behind that?
Well, Marcus, you forgot. Well, what you didn't see is right before you opened the door, a lady went to the other side and went out the door.
I saw it, but I didn't want to say anything. I didn't want to mention.
Uh-oh.
The clanging was more than weight.
Here district.
Oh, you heard it first on the Here District. I was trying to get her to go into that adjacent room on the other side.
Right. Like, oh,
like,
Lord.
She's like, what you had said, you know, everything else is just a letdown. But no.
Coaches follow other coaches.
Yeah.
Okay.
And Kentucky had done very well in the tournament. Joby Hall had them lifting weights. Marcus, Chris, and they were doing Nautilus equipment, and Coach Sutton found out.
Right.
He said, we're going to put our guys on a weight program like Kentucky. It started my freshman year, and we were like hard on the waist. Pretty soon, you saw a little bit come here.
Yeah.
You're like, oh, yeah. So by 4 years of college, think about this, 4 years of college lifting weights, it just became habit.
I mean, you were barrel chested. I mean, the legs were a little thin. But upper body was yoked. And
yes,
the thing that Sid told me was that I was like, Sid, doesn't that affect your shooting? It's taboo in today's game to lift weights, you know, to Kentucky and the college guys notwithstanding. But it was kind of thought to be taboo. We did a lot of calisthenics, push-ups, pull-ups, dips, all that kind of good stuff. And Sid was like, look, as long as you get out there and shoot, you know, a bunch of shots, get your touch back, you'll be fine. And I started going there with him and lifting weights. So yeah, that was it.
Yeah. And the season was so, I was a 6'4" guy playing inside as much as outside. And you know, we were taking a pound in MJ. We were taking like a, back then, Chris, when you went to the rack,
right,
you could expect to get hit.
Mm-hmm.
It was okay when you got hit in November, maybe December. But now when you start talking about February, March, April, and my body was wearing down. And that's when I realized, hey, I need to accelerate this a little bit more so I can maintain my strength when we get to the playoffs.
Yeah. That's a favorite story of mine. And you did use that to your advantage, man. You overpowered. I mean, you were tough to deal with down in the post, Sid.
Yeah, I was a tough guard in the post. And then back then, MJ, Chris, we could body more.
Yes, sir.
So if someone would make a cut to the basket, you can just chuck them a little bit.
Yeah.
I got tired of getting chucking people and getting knocked back.
Right.
So I said, you know, you need to get stronger. So I just stayed in that routine for a number of years.
Well, and so with you, Sidney Moncrief, I was thinking about you kind of coming into this interview, and I had a great, I had an opportunity to read your great book, Get Off the Bench. Group text, Chris, the Bucks Brotherhood, myself, and Sidney, Junior Bridgman, Harvey Catchings, Paul Pressey. And so Sid floated out some titles, and one of them was should I call it Get Your Ass Off the Bench?
Chris, I asked, I said, the title was going to be really Get Your Ass Off the Bench, Get in the Game. So
yes,
I
sir.
Asked him, do you think that's a good title?
Yeah. And I think Harvey Catchings, a couple of guys, I liked it. I thought it was a little...
You were not loud enough, man. If you liked it, I wish you would give it more support.
But reading the book, I mean, you referenced Get Your Ass Off the Bitch like four or five times. If I'd have known that you were referencing that comment that much, I would have been more vociferous in trying to get that title, man.
Yeah. Well, what I said was I can't put in the title because it might turn people off. But you can put it in the book here or there.
Yes. Right.
And it's we've all been there, Marcus, and Crenshaw, the Little Rock side of LA, but it's a tough, tough town. So for me, was not a big thing. But for Harvey and Junior,
they started blushing when they heard that. No, you don't see it. You can't say that. And Harvey was like, easy. That's how you talk, Chris. Easy. Wait a minute, there, young fella. Oh, man.
But, you know.
Yeah, no, we had a great crew. But, man, and I'm telling you, this is a great read. I actually gave a copy of it to my daughter, Shiloh, an aspiring ball player. You've seen her work out. And
yes, I have.
Going to be a freshman. But I told her, I want you to read this. You know, it's a quick read, but it's a great read. And I really think it'll help her. But, man, I was fascinated by so much, Sid. But it explains to me, and Chris, we've talked about this, how Sidney Moncrief, when I start thinking and reflecting on what kind of player, what kind of teammate he was, man, you had this freaking fire, this intensity. I mean, you're the nicest guy in the world, quiet, mild-mannered, yes, sir, no, sir. Coach Nelson never called him, probably Nelly in your latter days, but off the top, Coach Nelson, Coach Sutton, President Clinton, I mean, all that good stuff, just to a fault almost, Chris. But, man, on the court, I mean, you turned into Mr. Hyde. I mean, Dr. Jekyll, you became this just consummate competitor. And give us a little background on how that happened for you.
I think when things come easy, and we know sometimes guys are bigger. Just say when you go to school, you have guys that are bigger than what other people are, and they become the intimidating factor in the school or whatever. But when you're my size, I wasn't small. I wasn't big.
Right.
So you're kind of in the middle.
Mm-hmm.
You still have to, no one's going to bully you. However, you still have to be ready to protect yourself.
Yeah.
You have to be ready to fight, literally, mm-hmm. when you had to. And I think it developed from just fighting. I'm serious. I didn't go into that real deeply in the book, but I had so many fights. I lost so many fights.
Did you? Wow.
It wasn't like you were just winning fights. But you get into an argument, you kind of start playing a dozen, and before you know it, you're scrapping. I had a lot of that kind of stuff, and it carried over into basketball. So when I was on the basketball court, I just had that desire to compete and to win, and that came from just how I grew up, how I had to fight when I was young, how I would lose fights, and it didn't bother me. Losing was not a big deal to me. If I lost a fight, it wasn't like I wasn't. Matter of fact, I had two fights one day.
Yeah, two fights in one day, bro.
So I'm not sure who won, but I just remember always being respectful, being kind, being nice. However, when that line was drawn and someone crossed the line, it was on. Same way in basketball. That's where it came from.
How much of your basketball personality, if you will, Sidney, was defined by your experience playing for Coach Sutton at Arkansas? And I believe Coach Katie, Gene Katie, was he an
Coach
assistant
Katie
with
the assistant coach?
He was an assistant. So you had two of the toughest coaches to ever coach this great game of ours. How was it? Did they have an impact on you as far from a toughness perspective as well?
Well, my high school coach, Coach Oliver Elders, we all know how high school coaches are. Old school coaches that really push you to the limit. And I think that started the process, Coach Oliver Elders at Hall High School. It was just how you practice.
Yeah.
It was just how you practice. And they didn't accept half efforts. You couldn't drink water. Think about this, MJ, Chris. You couldn't drink water at practice. You couldn't even drink water in practice. How stupid was that? Don't. They wanted you just to be tough and to have grit and to fight through things. And so that started at Hall High School. And then at Arkansas, my goodness, Coach Sutton punished us with basketball drills and the intensity of practice sessions, the amount of time we spent on defense. We had Coach Katie and we had Coach Pat Foster, who coached at Houston, Lamar, and Nevada. So we had two elite high school. Yeah. I mean, he had coaches in college basketball. They were assistant coaches. And then back then, you played, when you played just at UCLA, when you played a really good program, it's like now, I guess, you played a really good program. It was just more, it was just condensed more. You know what I'm saying? It was just condensed more. And you were not playing freshman on freshman like now. You were playing sometimes junior on junior or sophomore on senior. So they were more experienced, stronger. And yet your game, level of your game needed to be a little bit higher because you were playing against more experienced, more physical players.
Yeah. But one of my favorite stories about you coming up, man, is I think it's Coach Elder. He had moved over to the school, I think, that you had transferred to, I believe. But I forget the exact scenario, but you called him OB. You went into the snack area. And what did OB stand for, first of all? But then whatever it was, it wasn't good. So everybody was giving him respect. The picture that you paint is beautiful. He's like, my super sophomores, my future champions, the guys that will get it done for me. And you like, and your brother and everybody else was like, hey, coach. And you were like, what's up, OB? talk about that. What does OB stand for?
Oliver Boone.
Okay.
Boone Elders. But mind you, in the community, in the neighborhood, they didn't call you. If you were a coach, you were not called by a coach. Nobody. You were called by whatever name the community had for you.
Right.
So I grew up hearing actually OB more than I did Coach Elders.
Okay.
Now, the sad part about the story is for just say 4 straight weeks, I was calling him Coach Elders.
Okay.
So it wasn't the first time I called him Coach Elder, which makes it even a sadder story.
Yeah, yeah.
Because I was, like, respectful. And that one day, I don't know what happened. But it also shows you the power of what you hear.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And people need to be careful for what they listen to, because I heard OB a lot more than I did Coach Elder. So at some point, that kind of recycled.
Yeah.
And so that morning, I said, hey, Coach, hey, OB. And he says, son? He says, son? That's disrespectful. You'll never play for me with that kind of attitude.
Yeah.
I felt like that tall. You know, my goodness.
Well, you know, we all have brain farts. I can remember, Sid, I was about 12 years old walking home from the playground in my neighborhood, and this 64 Impala with these two older dudes. They're probably 15, 16 at the time. One was Randy Brooks, who turned out to be my orthodontics, my oral surgeon later on. But so these two are cool dudes, coolest dudes in the neighborhood, tough guys, cool dudes, 64 Impala, Krager Mags. They listen to this song, Bernadette by the Four Tops. And so they pass by me on the corner of Park Glen and Northridge, Chris. And as they come by me, Randy Brooks has his window down, and I just give him the finger. I just like flipped him the bird. I don't know. It was a brain fart. I don't know why I did it. He looked at me and said, Bernadette. I did, hey, you know, and they put on the brakes. I took off and wound up hiding in the reservoir where we played some sandlot football. And they're like, we see you again. We gonna kick you, blah, blah, blah. But, you know, I don't know why I did it. I have no, this day, I don't know what got into me. That wasn't my personality. So when I saw that about OB, it just kind of reminded me of sometimes we can have these brain farts and do things out of character for us.
Yeah, that was a real big one right there. Coach Elders is 90. He's 93.
Still living, okay.
Not only still living, 2 years ago I took him to a high school championship game.
Wow, wow, that's
beautiful. And not only he was 90, his mind was sharp.
Yeah.
His mind, he knew what was happening in the game. He said, Sidney, who do you like out there? And I pointed out Nick Smith, because Nick Smith was playing for one of the teams. And then his teammate was the big kid that played at Oregon that transferred to Illinois. And Coach Elders, he's partial to the big guys. He said, you know, I like that big fella right there. He's going to be a really nice player. Okay. And sure enough, the kid is a really nice player.
And who is that? Who is that?
He played for Oregon as a freshman. He actually played as a freshman for Oregon.
Who is that, Chris? You know?
And he transferred. He played at Indiana last year. He's the leading scorer.
Okay.
And he, when I saw him play in high school, he reminded me, now don't get this twisted, he reminded me of Kareem.
Wow.
With his footwork.
Yeah. Kel Ware.
He wasn't Kareem.
What's his name?
Kel Ware. His last name is Ware. Ware. He's got the best measurables of any draft pick out there. He's up there with like the number one pick, the guy they got named Alexander Sarr from France. His measurables, height, wingspan, length, lateral movement, are right there. He's a beast. He's a phenomenon. They're kind of talking about guys that the Bucks may be there 23, but after this pre-draft process, he's going to be gone way before then.
Yeah, I watched him play, and I'm like, man, this kid, his motor didn't run.
Yeah, exactly.
All the time like it should.
Right.
Exactly.
But everything else was right there. But he picked that kid out just like 90-year-old coach. Think about it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And so the last thing from the book, well, maybe not the last, but one kind of turning point situation that I noticed for you, and we've all had them as athletes. Chris lost 50, 60 pounds over one summer between his freshman and sophomore years at UCLA. Mm-hmm. For me, it was you ever had Golden Bird Fried Chicken out in L.A., Sid? The Stennis family owns this chicken spot. One of their sons, Kevin, he was a weightlifter. He turned me on to this little Irish white guy over near Hamilton High School. He had a little funky gym, but he was into plyometrics and isometrics and strength and legs. Between my freshman and sophomore year, he told me to do this two or three times a week. You know, I did it 7 days a week. It's a whole little routine. I tried to get Junior Bridgman and some of these other guys to do it, but they couldn't hang. But it helped my vertical. It probably increased my vertical by 4 or 5 inches. I'm reading now, I think maybe your sophomore year high school, Coach Greenwood, he told you, I need you to do something different. I need you to do something a little out of character. And you didn't understand the reasoning behind it. But that weight vest and that track team, talk about what that meant to you.
Coach Greenwood, I was not a good player in 7th, 8th grade. 9th grade, they started busing in Little Rock. And so we went from all African-American schools to integrated, which was great. And Coach Greenwood, but ninth grade coach. And he was like the coolest cat. You know, these coaches back then, they were just really cool, but very intense. And he saw me. He looked at my frame. He said, boy, you kind of look skinny there. I was really like this right here. He was right. He was very generous by saying that. And he said, I want you to run track or long jump. No, high jump. I want you to high jump. And I want you to wear a weight jacket. And back then, weight jackets were not, Chris, form-fitting.
Big, bulky things, huh? Yeah.
They were not bulky, they just didn't fit tight. So they were flopping around.
Yeah.
Flopping around. So I spent every practice I had to wear the weight jacket. So that was extra work, because not only did you have to carry this weight jacket around, you had to control mentally it flopping around.
Yeah.
You know? And so that, doing that 1 year, changed my confidence level, number one. And number two, I think it helped my vertical and helped my speed, the lateral quickness. It helped immensely. And I didn't see his vision back then of why he wanted me to do this. But Marcus will tell you, I normally listen to coaches. But I was thinking to myself, what the, you know, if I just said that to him, like, what? But that changed my entire, I thought that changed my entire career, because it gave me that confidence, and also the fact that I had to mentally be tougher because all this was happening while I was practicing.
You're listening to a Bucks Plus audio production.
Sid, when we were prepping for this interview, Monis, who you met, he was giving us a lot of, you know, information, a lot of good nuggets about you. Were you aware of the fact that Jerry West was the Lakers, Jerry West was ready to draft you with the number one pick, or thought you should have been the number one pick. Were you, did you hear that story before you're aware of that? And if you've heard it, what do you think about that?
You know, back then we didn't have social media. We didn't have people giving out a lot of information. I had heard that was a possibility. They were looking at me. I had played with Magic in an international game. Actually, two or three games, right? And we were actually roommates.
Wow.
We played in Atlanta, and we played somewhere else in Lexington, Kentucky. So I had seen this guy play. So in my mind, I'm not being modest. I always looked at myself for where I was. I never tried to say I'm better than, if I was better than someone, I didn't even talk about it. However, I knew who was a hell of a lot better than I was. I was very much aware of that. I wasn't mad about it or upset about it. I just tried to get better. And sometimes you can try to get better and you never get to where they are. And that's okay. At least you try. Yeah. But for sure, Magic, I heard the story. I'm like, he would have been a stupid man to pick me. Everyone else in the group, I was okay with. I could say, okay, you might pick me before them, but not before him.
So you're saying, speaking of Bird, you guys lost to Bird and those guys in Elite Eight, right? Wasn't that correct in 79? So my question for you is, being around and being a college player, being contemporaries with these guys, when you saw what was the media coverage of Bird like back then, the Magic Bird rivalry? And when you look at today in the women's game, Caitlin Clark, Angel Reese, I don't know if you've been keeping up with that. Do you see any similarities with that? Or can you just comment on that, having lived through it and played through it?
Yeah, since? That's a good. Now, I played with Larry for 6 weeks, Marcus. I don't know if you knew that or not.
No, I didn't.
Yeah, I played in the World University Games. And that's going into my senior year. We spent 2 weeks in Louisville, Kentucky training. And we spent 4 weeks in Yugoslavia, Italy, and then we ended up in Sofia, Bulgaria. I watched Bird for 6 weeks.
Okay. Thoughts? Right.
Thoughts? What are your thoughts?
I mean, literally, the first practice at Kentucky, at Louisville, Danny Crum was the coach. I was like, oh my guy is the real deal. But that didn't really convince me. You know what convinced me? But I knew he can play. So put that aside, because we know guys that can play.
Sure.
We're playing in Sofia, Bulgaria. We're playing in the semifinals against Cuba. Cuba, as you know, hated the U.S. Yeah. That was real. I didn't realize. I was too naive to know that. You walk by those guys, hey, what's up, man? They're like,
sticking Americano.
Every country. The entire African continent. Like, what's up, bro? What's up, man?
Yeah.
So Cuba hated us. We were the best team. We're down by 20. Darrell Griffin was on that team. We're down by 20 first half. Danny Crum got into it with the hot dog point guard. They get into a verbal. This guy was, he's a and from that, a fight broke out.
Okay.
Once a fight, it would be, Marcus, no, I don't exaggerate much. This would have been an international incident.
Okay.
It was a serious fight.
I remember that. All out brawl chair.
James Bailey, somebody cut him with a beer bottle, so he was bleeding. Darrell Griffin had I wanted to laugh. He came in the huddle after he had a big knot on his head right there. You know, you're in the huddle. Someone had hit him with the camera. You know, he went off for 20-something points the second half. But I knew Barrett was real when the fight broke out. And guess who was leading the fight?
Larry Bird. Okay.
When I see someone that fights like that and plays like that, it was like, oh my goodness, he's the real deal. And, you know, I was in there trying to fight. And this is the story I tell when I do my keynotes. Yeah, I'm a fighter. I protect Marcus. I protect my teammates. And I protect myself. So I'm like, okay, who can I go hit? I'm looking around. And big player, the best big player was like, he was on like 6'7", but he was built like a hit, muscles on top of muscles. So I'm sitting there, okay, here you go. I go to him. So I went up to the guy, and he picked up his leg and kicked me in the chest 3 times. Like, okay, let me find somebody else. Oh, I'm like, funny. I'm not messing with that dude.
Yeah.
But that's when I knew Bird was more than, which meant that if it came down, not that you want to fight in basketball, but there's still a certain toughness.
Sure.
That has to be here and you have to protect. So that's when I knew, he's the deal. He's the real deal.
Yeah. Yeah, speaking of fights, and I'm at Crenshaw High School. It's a summer league game, Sid, Chris, and we're playing against Jefferson. And it's a championship game. It's just summer league, but it's a championship. And we were the top two teams in the city, and we're going at it. Things get rough. There's some skirmish under the basket. Kind of calms down, but our team manager, Michael Wall, won't let it die. And he starts saying, F you, mofos, F you. So they turn around, Michael Niles, who played in the NBA, he turns around, who is this? And they start jumping him. So the brawl breaks out. All right, so I'm there. My dad is there watching, but I'm in the middle of the fray. And I'm like, I got my fist up, just waiting for somebody to come at me so I can do something. I'm ready, but, I'm hoping nothing happens. But nobody comes at me. I find out years later from a good friend of mine, Brad Schur. He told me that the reason that nobody came at me was because my dad was behind me grabbing guys and tossing them to the side as they would try and sucker punch me from behind. He grabbed, put them in a headlock, grab another. He taught at a juvenile delinquent school down in Bossier City, Louisiana. So he was used to take a couple of guys with headlock and bump their heads together. So I mean, in our day in the NBA, one of my favorite stories too, Chris, is we're playing against Washington. The old Bullet. And so Rick Mahorn and Sid are jostling under the basket, playing aggressive. Rick kind of forearms him in the back of the head. Sidney gives him the most vicious elbow to the throat. Rick reaches back with his right arm to punch Sid in the back of the head. I'm behind Rick. I grab Rick's elbow. I just grab his elbow as it's coming back. Rick turns around, looks at me. He starts coming at me, and I say, peace, brother. and he just starts laughing. And we were kind of friends. I knew him through John Williamson, so we knew each other, respected each other. But Sid, in our day, talk about God, people don't understand. You and Danny Ainge, you and John Long. Sid, Chris, I'm telling you, this dude was like you, Chris. Chris is like that too. I mean, it was no back down.
You never want to start fights, right? You never really want to hurt anyone.
Right.
But at the same time, especially if you're a two guard, Marcus, you were bigger. You know what I'm saying? You were bigger, more athletic, big shoulders, strong. But when you're my size and you're chasing guards so much, and it's a different way when you're defending that if you don't do that, if you don't, then you're meat pretty much.
Yeah.
So, I just couldn't allow someone too many times to do something like that because it would give them carte blanche just to think that it's okay. And it's not okay. And normally if someone would do something, I would give them a pass.
Yeah.
I was like, man, did that do this to me? I'm saying that to myself. Did he actually do
that? Right, right.
But the second time.
Yeah.
You remember John Super John Williamson?
Oh, of course, yeah. Super John, Indiana Pacers, New Jersey Knicks.
Hey,
yeah.
Chris, he could score.
Yeah.
I mean, he had 50. He had 50 a couple games.
Right.
Remember that? And that's he was like, I remember playing against the Nets in New Jersey. I was a rookie. And so I remember going for a rebound. I was a good offensive rebound. And Super John went like, he hit me about. Now, I'm not exactly, hit me five times, just like that. Yeah. I mean, boom, 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 just right here. Boom, 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 hard. And I tried to get him back, but I said something to him. But, back then, you could talk to people. They were not taking wolf tickets. You had to show them action. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
You can talk all you want, but until you would do something. But I couldn't get to him because, I think I was on the bench after that. I didn't play too much.
You and Michael Jordan, what was that about? Did you guys, how testy was that matchup? Was it, I would imagine it was a level of respect there, but Michael, man, he was a rookie, Sid, playing in LA when I was with the Clippers, and I set a elbow screen, that Detroit pick, I set a blind screen on him. He came in hard and high with his elbows, and so I grabbed him. I was like, hey, rookie, watch the elbows. He snatched away from me and said, hey, vet, watch the screen. I'm like, okay. But he's a tough customer. How yeah. you and him, man, I'd pay to see that matchup. What was that like?
Yeah, it was people don't give Michael, here's what they don't give Michael credit enough for, is how smart he was.
Uh-huh.
And so if you're guarding him, you had to know that he was always picking his spots. A lot of guys, he started off weak side. With Michael, he'll start the game, and he'll just let everyone get off. Right? But in my mind, I just knew it was a matter of time. So I was always on guard. If he's weak side, he's going to just play like he's just over there. He's going to make that cut strong side for the ball. But I couldn't guard him. You know, the bottom line was I couldn't guard him, but I wanted to make it hard for him to score.
Yes.
Yeah. Main thing with Michael, you make it hard. I would Marcus, remember, I would deny him out.
Yeah.
I wouldn't just let him catch in certain spots. But once he caught the ball, he had so many things he could do. The first 50-point game he ever had was on us.
You don't see many men 6'5 dominate the game like Michael Jordan does. They get it to Jordan, who's double teamed, but comes out of nowhere. Double teamed, the third man coming over to help, and he goes up in between them.
Wow. Okay.
You were not there, but Don Nelly, I love him to death. He had this great strategy. He said, okay, here's what we're going to do. Playing Michael Jordan. Sydney, I want you to guard him, push up on him, which is fine. I want you to push him. I want you to just cut him off and force him one way, another way. So make it, right. Let's make his first move, cut it off. His second move, Mike Dunleavy, I want you to come. I want you to double team him. I did my part.
And they've played some good defense when they've had to. And look, Michael Jordan for the layup.
Timeout, Milwaukee, trailing by 7. There have been a 15-point turnaround.
I did my part. But every time he would go the other direction, Mike Dunleavy would come. He would split. over, go in and dunk the ball to get. He had 18 points in the fourth quarter, something like that.
Right, and this is and Nelly like this is Nelly before Hawaii and Nelly's Kush and playing barefoot. I played barefoot golf. Nelly played barefoot golf with me over in Hawaii a few years back. But Mike. So Michael had the 50-point game. Dunleavy Senior. The funny story about him, he came to Milwaukee, Sid, Chris, and I didn't know him at all. New York City guy, he just came out of the stockbroker business as a stockbroker. And the first time I talked to him on the bus, he was like, "So yo, Marcus, man, where'd you get all that shimmy, 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 shake, jam, shimmy, jam, jam, man? Yeah, you know when you go to the hole, bro. I love the way, man, you give him the shimmy. it was the craziest, almost as crazy Sid as Chuck Nevitt, 7'4", that knew every rap lyric. It's like a jungle sometimes. It made me wonder how those kinds of things, out of character things, really surprised you. But that was Dunleavy, man.
But he was a great teammate, and I love having him on the court when I play.
Yeah, yeah.
Because there's no fear.
Yeah, yeah. He gonna give you everything he got. Everything
right, there's no fear, and that's all you want with the teammate. Is just don't go out there and play scared. You know, don't be playing scared. Just play like you're out here, and you know what you're doing. And
he. Yep. Sid, when you and my dad teamed up, man, those Buck squads, right? You guys, major squads, probably should have won a championship. When you look back on it, why do you think you didn't get over the hump in the East and win a title or at least get to the finals?
We were not good enough.
like what pieces?
I'm serious. Let me say this. Marcus Johnson, Naismith Hall of Famer. So let's put that on the table. So hypothetically, Sidney Moncrief Hall of Famer, Marcus Johnson Hall of Famer, Bob Lanier Hall of Famer. That's how many?
Three.
Boston.
Yeah.
7 at one time. Philadelphia. 5.
So who the seven Boston? I know Bird, McCarrish, Pell, DJ, Tiny. Yeah. No.
Well, remember at one point Bill Walton was on that team.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
We played in the playoffs.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah,
Pete Maravich was on that team when we played in the playoffs.
No, you're right. Right.
So there were 7.
And wow. We'll
play some minutes. So, Chris, the reality is when I look back on those teams that we had, Marcus, the best shot we had was when we played Seattle.
Yep.
Mm.
That was looking back on it. And he will tell you we never went into a game or a series thinking that they were better than us.
Nope.
Yeah.
Yep.
We never really did. But remember, now looking back, you look at the teams they had and the players they had, and you start counting.
Yeah.
You're like, man, that team was loaded. You
know? Yeah. Yeah.
That team was loaded. As a matter of fact, can you think of a team right now that would have five Hall of Famers on their starters? Just look forward.
Yeah. No, that's tough. I mean, Boston, you might have four. Boston,
three
you might
or
have
four.
Four.
Yeah.
Porzingis, I'm counting just from the four and
eight. Whoa, Porzingis?
Hall of Famer.
Wow.
Well, from the if Vlade Divac is a Hall of Famer, I don't know.
I'm just saying
if Vlade and some of these other foreign guys
take him out, Marcus. Give me three guys. I said Tatum, no doubt. Brown,
yeah,
no doubt.
Yeah, right. Now then, I mean, Drew Holiday, because of Michael Cooper's selection this year as a defensive player that never made an All-Star team, championships or more, whatever it was. I would think Drew probably has a pretty, what do you think, pretty solid chance of getting in based on his second championship and his defensive acumen.
All right, so that's three. They said give him that.
Yeah. No, you're right.
Now you had Golden State when they made the run. They had Kevin Durant.
Mm. Yeah.
At least four.
Steph Curry, right?
Yeah.
You had Thompson.
Yeah.
Clay Thompson, three. And it's a good argument to be made, Draymond Green.
Draymond, yeah. I think he'll get in.
Yeah, but that's four.
Yeah.
So we're talking five.
Yeah.
And we're not even talking about five. So, Chris, that was a tough time because we were just – and it's a strong argument for me, I don't know anyone else, to say the Philadelphia team that won a championship was one of the greatest teams ever.
Yeah.
I didn't say the greatest. I said one. It's a real argument that the Boston teams, I'm just saying people in our conference.
Sure.
Right.
Yeah.
100%. 100%.
It's a no-brainer to say the Lakers were.
100%.
Know? So that was a tough time. We had four teams, and then Seattle, when they won it that year, they were, that was a very loaded team. Jack Sigma, DJ, Lenny Shelton. Downtown Freddie Brown.
Yeah. Well, and the thing about them, as you mentioned, they had won it the year before. Yeah, they lost to the win. They've been to the finals twice, 2 years in a row. Lost to Washington the first time, Bobby Dandridge, Elvin Hayes. Mm-hmm. Won it that next year. And then we played them. We had them down 3-2 at home. We lost that game. Johnny Johnson got me off my square, Chris. He got up all in my face, and I started pushing him and talking trash. And Bob Lanier, the diver, was egging me on, Chris.
Well, that's talking trash?
That's right, MJ. Go at him. So I was like, he got me all hyped up and threw me off my – got me off my square. Smart move. But see, game seven in Seattle. And I was telling Chris this, and you said it. I knew we were the better team. I knew we could beat these guys. No question in my mind. And I came out. I didn't look at that tape, Sid, for like 40-plus years. Never looked at Game 7. I was so just despondent over how it wound up. Now, Junior Bridgman got hurt earlier in that series. He was a non-factor for us, and he was sixth man of the year type performer. But when I looked at that tape, Sid, what I saw was, and you can speak to this in terms of your overall philosophy about, your book and life and business, I came out way too cool. It's like I'm in my Dr. J thing, I'm just kind of cool, just knowing that we're gonna, do what we always do, find a way to get it done down the stretch. And they came out with that finals experience. They knew game seven, every possession is like a dogfight. Yes. I blocked Johnny Johnson's shot one time, he got the ball back, put it back in. So that pretty much nullifies the block. I'm kinda patting myself on the back. Yeah, old man. Yeah, but I think that experience, I mean, there's no substitute, that's one of the benefits of like the Celtics. I mean, the experience of being there before.
And I just forgot, who was one of the best players on that team that people don't even talk about now?
Lonnie Shelton or Dennis, let's see, Dennis, Gus.
Gus Williams.
Gus. Gus, the Wizard. Yeah,
yeah.
Gus.
Off the chart.
Think about that. That team, like you said, they had the experience. They really did. And then they had guys that could ball. But I thought we were in position to win that series. And then we would have had a good shot, I think, at winning a championship that year. But that's what people don't understand. You have windows, and you miss those opportunities. You just don't know.
Well, we'd have played the Lakers with Kareem and Magic. You think we could have got them, Sid? With Jamal Wilkes and that whole crew, you think we'd have? That'd have been our next round opponent. I often wonder about that, how we'd have matched. We played them. We played them well. We played them well that year.
Yeah, I'm doing the whistling right now. I'm like,
hey, who's guarded Magic that year? Who's guarding Magic? Okay. And what was your game? It's it. What was your game plan?
Magic was the type of player you could guard him until he didn't want you to guard him.
One of them dudes.
He would make sure everyone else is involved. So I'm not saying he's one of the greatest players ever. However, he would make sure everyone else got fed first. But when he wanted to do it, and it could be a strong argument, and no one talks about this. I thought about it two nights ago. The greatest performance in the history of the NBA Finals.
Mm, yeah, his rookie year.
Was by Magic Johnson.
Yeah. As a rookie.
42, 16, and 7. Yeah.
As a 20-year-old rookie.
Turned 20. Just turned 20.
And Michael's my Michael.
Yeah.
LeBron, you can put all, you can stick, Barry, you name all these great players, but the greatest performance I've ever seen.
Yeah, you're right.
In a finals, NBA finals, was that performance.
Golly.
And that goes to my point. You could guard him until he said, I don't want you to guard me. And then when he said that, he's unguardable. But he didn't have to be unguardable because they had Kareem and all these other guys that he could get the ball to.
Quick follow-up on MJ, Michael Jordan. There's been an article released recently about how the home scorekeeper at Chicago Stadium tended to give MJ love a little more on his stats and steals and blocks and points. Do you think that that's even a legitimate thing? Or you played against the guy, you compete against the guy. Was MJ really all of that? Because since Michael Jordan, the years have passed, right, Sid? You've noticed that they've detracted from his greatness. There's all these questions people have about MJ. When I was coming up, there was no question. It was blasphemy. You was throwing down when people used to talk about Jordan like they talk about him now. What's your take on all this, Sid?
Well, Marcus, they padded stats for all the great players at home. That wasn't unusual. I don't think anyone could say that Michael was the only player that had the benefit of playing at home with his stats.
Mm.
I just hadn't seen that. Because sometimes you feel like you have these other guys, you're like, yeah, I mean, was that an assist? I don't think that was an assist. Not Michael. I'm not talking about other great players. I don't think that was an assist. They caught the ball and dribbled three times and shot it. You know? So I don't buy into that totally. Does it take away from his greatness? No more than Barry Bonds' greatness is taken away by being tarnished by the rumor of doing steroids. That Barry Bonds is still the greatest hitter, one of the greatest baseball players ever. So that does not take away, in my mind, the greatness at all.
Yeah.
It has nothing to do with it.
Yeah, I saw a stat on Barry Bonds. I forget the exact stat, but if you take away those years that he was allegedly juicing, he still was MVP four or five times. His numbers were still just top 10 all time in terms of slugging and home runs and all that. So that is interesting. So now the trade happens.
You're listening to a Bucks Plus audio production.
In 84, I get traded.
Broke my heart.
Harvey Catchings, Terry Cummings, Craig Hodges, and Ricky Pierce go to the Bucks. You've shared with me that kind of changed the dynamic. And talk about that in terms of chemistry. You know, on paper, it might look like a good move, but just in terms of chemistry and some of those intangibles.
Yeah, I would say great teammates, Ricky Pierce, Paul Preston.
Yeah.
Right. So let's get that on the table. Nothing wrong there. However, I was on protest for at least 2 days. I'm not a protest kind of guy, but it broke my heart because I just felt we were still, sometimes you feel like, give them a little more time. We've seen that before where give them another couple of years. Mm-hmm. And I just felt that didn't happen.
Right.
And I think had it happened, we might have had a better shot. Yeah. Might have had a better shot. So the chemistry, you have to get to know people over again. Nelly had to get to understand their skill sets again. That takes about 2 years. Terry Cummings was a beast, an absolute beast. So it was Ricky Pierce, Craig Hodges, and Paul Preston. But it's still not like chemistry is so important when you start building bonds with teammates, not just off the court, but on the court. We didn't do much on off the court, did we? But I felt like we were right here.
I mean, so
sometimes you don't really need that off the court bond when you're playing with great players. You really don't. When you're playing with great players, you really don't need it.
Yeah, you don't. No, you don't.
You need it when you're playing against with average players. You know what I'm saying?
Great point.
They can't read things on the court very well. And if you make a pass, they might not read it. And so all those things are important when you're playing against, when you're playing with guys that are not as talented. Yeah. But I felt we needed more time. That's what I felt. I was very disappointed, but I had to be a big man, put on my big boy underwear and just kind of suck it up and just move on. But it was that's literally nothing has broken my heart like that. I'm in basketball.
Yeah. Really but to your point about chemistry and talent, but it also takes, Sid, great leadership from the coaching perspective. So look at Boston this year. Now, Joe Mazzulla, I thought, was going to be the weak link for them down the stretch in terms of his inexperience. I don't know a whole lot about Joe, but he hadn't been around that long. So I thought that might rear its ugly head and that might cause them to struggle at times. Then all of a sudden, post-game championship, Jrue Holiday's talking to Brendan Hayward and Jamal Crawford, some other people. He's talking about some of the stuff Joe did. He's like practices the first hour. He would have no dribble practices where you had to pass and cut and pass and cut. And Jrue was like, it was some of the most unorthodox, crazy. But there's genius in that.
Yes.
And so you look at Doug Collins with Chicago. He couldn't get him over the hump. Phil Jackson comes in and starts lighting sage and incense in the locker room and giving guys books and putting in the triangle. That worked. Steve Kerr at Golden State. You know, Rudy Tomjanovich took over for Don Chaney in Houston. You know, go ahead, Chris.
So wait, you say if you would have had different leadership at the top, you guys could have got over the hump?
Am I saying that about the Bucks?
Yeah. About your squad was sitting in the 80s. Could you have made the finals if you had different leadership? I mean, I'm trying to figure out where you're going with that, MJ.
Well, here's what I get out of it. And I'm going to push back a little bit. Great players still make coaches.
Right.
Great players being put. I was like you, Marcus, with their head coach. I was like, I don't know. But he instilled confidence in those guys. Right.
Yeah.
And something he did that made him. But at the end of the day, players make plays.
Right.
Coaches put them in great positions. But, man, how many great plays have we seen from championship teams where, you know, the coaches probably called some damn play and they did something different?
All the time.
The players just get the ball in your best player's hand. That's the play you run. But you know what struck me is, and I coached in the NBA. I think I know a little bit about coaching. I'm just still shocked at how many pick and rolls teams run when the game's on the line.
Because what? It's so easy to it's easier to defend. Bringing everybody together in one area.
There you go. I learned that from Don Nelson. He had a philosophy that the last play of the game. Don't run a pick and roll if you can avoid it. I know sometimes they run it to get a switch on a weaker player. I understand that philosophy. But when you bring that extra defender, especially when we play, it was different. They would normally hedge. And sometimes it looks so crowded. They're at half court half the time when they run their pick and rolls. Right. And then by the time they get the switch and make the play, they could have just waited, thrown the ball at the elbow, and that player elbow could catch it and then make a play. So I don't know if I would risk pick and rolls as much trying to get that matchup all the time like I've seen in the past. Because typically, if you have a great player, they're going to score on that play. I don't care how good a defensive player you are.
Yeah.
Marcus, you're going to score on me.
Right.
I can't stop you.
Yeah, I can make it hard for you.
Huh?
I can make it hard for you, but you're going to, if you're a great player, you're going to find a way to get it done.
You're going to find a way to get foul or get the ball to a good player. And so I think that's kind of going by the wayside. A little bit, but like those guys can make plays for Boston. They made plays, and Dallas didn't. They couldn't make it. They couldn't make plays. And they played selfish, and they just didn't play. They didn't play team basketball. It was just not. It was not the Maverick team that had beat Minnesota, was it?
Right. No, it wasn't.
Yeah,
totally different. And to your point, Chris, about Nelly, and I'll say this about Nelly. I mean, Nelly was really good for me because Nelly kind of approached you as an empty vessel. Me. As a player, as good as I was in college, player of the year, still some areas in my game that needed to be improved. And, you know, he really filled me up with that NBA knowledge. But I will say this, is that we could have used a big, strong, physical rebounder, inside presence that they thought Kent Benson was going to be. So they wound up trading Swin Nader from UCLA, played behind Bill Walton, to Buffalo for the third pick to draft Benson 1, draft me 3. And Swin was coming off a season, Chris, where he averaged like 15 and 14.
Yeah.
I mean, so just over, sometimes you can overthink situations, yeah. Get too excited about the prospects. And, you know, so that would be my only comeback.
If I had to put my finger on, other than what Marcus said, if I had to put my finger on one reason why we didn't win.
Yeah.
An NBA title. And that is because we lost Dave Myers.
Yeah, that's good point. Great point.
What did Dave bring, Sid?
Dave, he was a stretch four. He could shoot basketball. He would set picks. He would dive, take the defense in with them, create other situations. He could guard their best big player. He could play defense. He could get that 50-50 ball. He would get it.
Yeah.
He would get it. And when he got hurt, Marcus.
Yeah.
I think we were on our way, but when we lost him, we lost a lot of offensive flexibility.
Right. Yeah.
Facts.
Yeah.
He's such a big key, I thought.
Yeah. He played my rookie year. He sat out the second year because of that sciatica in his leg. Came back the third year and played well. That was the year we lost to Seattle. Maybe your rookie year, Sid, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, but rookie year.
Yeah. Yeah, it's funny, Chris, with Sidney's rookie year. So I'm holding out for more money. I always held out for more money. It was like, you know, I wanted to get paid commensurate to, you know, I'm first team all pro.
As you should.
I'm first team all pro. I'm making $110,000 and all these other dudes are making like Bobby Wilkinson making pro.
So
Junior Bridgman. I think this is Sid's rookie year. Sid, Junior Bridgman, I talked to him like, so how's everything going, blah, blah, blah. He's like, yeah, everything's good. So now how's this rookie mind creep? I know about him from High on the Hogs and all that Sports Illustrated cover, which is one of my favorite, one of the most iconic in the history of Sports Illustrated covers. I was like, Junior, what's the mind creep about? He's like, M, you ain't going to believe this dude. I was like, why not? He's like, we tried to get him to carry the ball bags and told him that that's what all rookies do. And Sidney said, I ain't no rookie. I've been playing basketball all my life. I ain't carrying no bag. I was like, okay.
That's what's up.
I kind of like that.
That's what's up. That's what's up.
Yeah. Do you remember that, Sid?
Yeah, I remember. I'm like, no, you're not. I said, you're not hazing to me, man. I'm not. They said, take that bag and put on their plan. I said, I'm not taking your bag. You take your own bag.
And so then one of my holdouts was a benefit to Sid. I held out again. Sid's maybe third or fourth year. I forgot the year.
Second or third year.
It's his third year. I held out. That's when I got my big contract, but I had to really go to the mat. And so the Bucks were playing hardball. A contract is a contract. The only leverage I had was to withhold my services. And so I'm not signing until you pay me commensurate to what I'm doing as a player. I was, you know, voted by the general managers as the guy you start a franchise with, all this good stuff. And so I sit out, Chris, the first 18 games of the year. So I know the Bucks are just going to struggle big time. So they're going to come on their hands and knees begging me to come back. After about five or six games, I'm out in L.A. hanging with my boys, you know, DeJuan's nightclub with the Jackson 5 and all that, just hanging out, doing my thing, partying, staying up all that, just going crazy. And the Bucks, to my chagrin, are not losing. They're like winning. They start off like, you know, 6-2, 7-3, 8. After 18 games in, they're like 12-6. And this dude here is just taking the league by storm. He had elevated himself to one of the better players in the league. And
Thank you, Mark.
And so I had my agent, Willie Knowles, at the time, the late great Willie Knowles. I told him to call the Bucks, Wayne Embry, and tell him that. Let's put these negotiations on hold. This is mid-December now. They're 12-6. So I'm going to Hawaii for like 2 weeks, and we'll deal with it when I get back. I didn't have the money to go to Compton. You know, they had no money. But it was my big bluff. And Wayne Embry was like, well, no, tell him don't leave. You know, we'll get something done. And we got something done within the next few days. And it wasn't a moment too soon because Sidney, I mean, you took that opportunity. You talk about it in your book. But, you know, when these opportunities present themselves, you got to leap at them.
You got to take them, and you can't. And I was never arrogant. I never had ill feelings what you were doing. As a matter of fact, I never said, okay, I'm better than this guy. I always tell people I'm just balling.
Yeah.
Like when you just play on the playground, whatever.
Yep.
Just use that ball. And people ask me all the time how I did what I did. And I'm like, I don't know. Yeah. I was just out there playing basketball, having a good time and playing basketball. And when you came back, I knew the type of player you were, first of all. So it wasn't like if somebody was a rudy poop and they're holding out, you're like, yeah. But I, it's like, hey, do what you need to do. But it did open up a door for me. And in my book, I talk about Brian Winters when he got hurt.
Right.
Talk about that. And he got hurt, Chris. And I was, I think that was my second year. You were still, mm-hmm. I started, that's when I first started rolling.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I was like rocking and rolling, just really playing well. And he came back. He was ready to play. And Nelly called me in the office. He said, Sid, you've been playing great, but I have this rule that a starter can never lose his job through an injury. So yeah. I'm going to have to put you back on the bench. And I say, okay, coach. I'm thinking in the back of my mind, let him get injured again. You know,
I'll be back.
But I wasn't upset because I tell people there will still be opportunities for you to do great things in your life. Although yeah. you might have a little setback or you think you've been wrong for a reason. Life is, if you live long enough, people will find that you just have to keep doing what you do and do it at a higher level. That's what I tried to do.
Well, and the thing that I took from your book, Sid, is like, you don't make a lot of excuses. There aren't a lot of blame game going on. You're not worried about what the next man is doing. Everything is about you and the person and personal accountability. And to me, that's the most powerful message that you can give in business and in athletics. It's like, dude, as an athlete, businessman, entrepreneur, whatever it is, it's all about you. It's all about that dude in the mirror. Can you speak to just a little bit more on that and where you got that source of inspiration?
Yeah. Marcus and I talked about this before the show, and you're going to have setbacks. Like when I was in Phoenix, when I retired, I kind of knew mentally you just get tired. It's like you get tired of the game or the games. You just kind of like, okay, I'm done. I had a dealership, so it wasn't like I didn't have anything to do, but I'm a baller. Mm-hmm. I'm not an auto dealer. So I had the dealership, and I opened another dealership in Phoenix, and I'm out there, and I knew just enough, but did not know enough about the automotive business, and definitely didn't know enough to be in Phoenix, which is like the Las Vegas. It's like every criminal that wants to hide out from Chicago and New York.
Is it Phoenix?
Now they're in Vegas, but they used to be in Phoenix, you know. Oh. And I was naive. I didn't know all this. So I ended up opening a dealership in Phoenix, losing a ton of money. I had this incident with this guy that stole about $225,000 from my dealership because of a used car deal that my used car manager didn't scrutinize. And I didn't have the savvy to be on top of it. And it ends up that I really did feel threatened, this guy. He would come in my office. I was trying to get my money, Marcus, Chris. I went back to the neighborhood, man. You may have my money, man. It's like, my money tomorrow. It was one of those kind of deals. Come in with a German Shepherd dog, which I love German Shepherd. I just got a 3-month-old German Shepherd puppy. I love those dogs. And he would have a case. And I went to the police department, and I said, hey, this guy, he's gotten me for $200,000+. I'm letting you know right now, might do something bad to him, you know, if he doesn't have my money. And what can you all do? And they're like, we can't do anything. It's a civil matter. So we're in the office with the guy. And had my brother been there, had my brother not been there, Ed, my oldest brother, he just happened to be in the room. And I just kind of, for a minute, got a golf club and attacked the guy. Just, you know, felt he had a silver case. Someone said he had a gun, and I'm not
open carry. Arizona open carry.
Yeah, right. And so had my brother been there, had not been there, I would have been charged with murder.
Wow.
Seriously. And I swung the club. The guy put his arm up, broke his arm. I might have swung it again. And my brother, I'm like, man, what took you so long? My brother.
Was it break this up? Yeah.
He grabbed me. And so I got arrested, and that's the first time I had been arrested. I'm like, and I remember being in a jail cell. It's kind of funny now. I was in Phoenix. I was in Glendale first. Glendale's a small town. I'm chilling like in the jail cell. You know, I'm the only person in there, like chilling out and talking to my wife and trying to make some arrangement. And the guy said, oh, we're going to have to take you to Maricopa jail midnight. I'm like, I hope not. So I'm sleeping. They knock on my door. Oh, okay, we have to go to the big jail. I get to the big jail, and that's like what you see on TV. Like, okay. You know, like
Bubba and all the dudes.
Yeah, smoking marijuana. You know, so yeah. Just like yeah. I'm sitting there looking like I'm a gangster. You know, yeah. I knew I'm sitting like a gangster, and this guy looked at me. He said, "What are you in here for? You don't look like a criminal type." You know. One guy recognized me. Hey, you said Devon Creek.
What you say? What you say? You told him you acknowledge him?
Yeah, man. I said, "What's up, dude? You better leave me alone." But I was telling Marcus, even during that time, I didn't really blame. It was me. That was me. I put myself in that position by being lax in my business practice. I put myself in that position by not being able to have emotional intelligence and control my anger at that time. And I was facing minimum. That was a weapon. A golf club in Phoenix is a deadly weapon in some other states. And in Phoenix, it was mandatory 15 years. Minimum. If you're found guilty. Fortunately, I went to trial and was found not guilty of the crime. But it was really close. Things happen in our lives that shouldn't happen, but they do. And I've always learned just to put it behind me. Like bankruptcy, divorce. I've had all of those things happen to me over my life. And I'm like, you know, that doesn't define. It doesn't have to define who you are when you make a mistake. Right. It really doesn't. We're human, so we're going to make mistakes. That's not making excuses. That's the reality.
Yeah.
So guilt can cause you to keep making those mistakes, right?
Sure.
Yeah, but sucking up and saying, hey, you say, hey, I want to live my best life now.
Absolutely.
Right? And get off the bench. I have this get off the bench book, and guys, I have a hat. It's like it's the same color blue, and it says it's get off the bench.
Yeah, and that's what's up.
On my dashboard. And every time I have something to do that I hadn't done, guys, I say, get your ass off the bench and get that done.
Yeah.
It's just a reminder for me. So we all have things happen in our lives. But if you're, Chris, if you're lucky enough like we are, you have time. you have time just to make it right.
And yes, sir.
In the meantime. Yeah.
Yes, sir. And Sid, I wanted to share something with you quick, MJ, then I'll let you finish. That was an amazing story you just shared. But so I had a chance to win a national championship in 95. We beat the Arkansas Razorbacks. Coach President, I know. You see, I had to drop that in there. No, but so Sid, as part of the festivities, you get to visit the White House. So before I go to the White House, my dad, he has like all these T-shirts. He had this saying, "Yeah, baby," that he did on one of the broadcasts. So he has a T-shirt he wants me to give President Clinton.
Goes down. Later.
Yeah, baby. Yeah, baby.
So I'm kind of like, what? Like, you know, you want me to give President Clinton a T-shirt? He's like, yeah, tell him I played with Sidney Moncrief and with the Milwaukee Bucks, and you know, you'll be all good. So Sid, I kid you not. When it was my chance to go meet President Clinton, I roll up on him. I got the T-shirt in hand. I roll up. I say, "Hey, Coach, President Clinton, my dad played with Sidney Moncrief." He's like, "Oh, Sidney Marcus, yeah, I know your dad." Like, oh, he went off. He was glowing about you. He went on for about 15, 20 seconds. You know, meeting the president is a brief conversation, but just know that at the highest of levels, your name, you know, is ringing troops. Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
He's an Arkansas guy, and every time I see him, he'll tell the story. He'll tell the same story every time about how I helped him become governor one year.
Yes, right, sir. Right.
I'm sure that is, but I said, whatever. He said, you know, but he's a good man.
Yes, sir.
Mm-hmm. But wrapping it up, Sid, I mean, so looking at there was a part in the book, too, that I don't want to belabor it, but you talked about your first 2 years, you kind of were on the bench, then you got off the bench, had productive 6 years, two-time defensive player of the year, all-star multiple times, all-pro. And then you say that around, I guess, year 8 or 9, that you lost the motivation, the desire. What was going on with Sidney Moncrief? Because I wasn't aware of that. What was going on with Sidney Moncrief, who I always knew as a self-motivated high achiever?
Okay. You have to keep the main thing the main thing.
Yeah.
Keep the main thing the main thing. So I think at some point, most NBA players go from being players to coaches. They go from being players to GMs.
Yeah.
And they don't keep the main thing the main thing. And I always say, coaches coach. I do my leadership and my talk to coaches coach and players play. I think I was getting guys outside of that lane.
Okay.
A little bit mentally.
Mm-hmm.
And like, you guys trade. You know, that did impact me, right?
Wow.
But the main thing was the main thing because coaches coach, GM do what they do, right? Make decisions, trades, and players play. So that's what I meant by that, Marcus. I think I was no longer in the mode of just keeping the main thing, which is being a basketball player.
Yeah.
Okay. Right. And I think the wear and tear of my body, I could have played more games. You know, load management, you know when it started? It started when I played for the Bucks, and Herb Cole did not want me to play X number of games because of my knees.
Mm. Bone on bone. I mean, you had no cartilage.
Yeah, but he wanted me to make sure I was okay in the playoffs. So I missed probably 20, 30 games one year that I could have played.
Wow. Mm. Okay. Mm. So you were the poster boy for
OG load management.
OG load management.
Well, yeah, but it was never, you know, back then, nobody really cared, and they didn't see it as that. But I said, I can play. But no, he doesn't want you to play until you want to make sure you're healthy. And so that when that happens to you, when that ability to play the game you love, and then you start analyzing too many other things that's happening in basketball, you did not keep the main thing, Sidney.
Right. Okay.
Which is playing basketball. Right.
So what advice would you have for the Milwaukee Bucks in terms of where they are now, what they can be, what do they need? You know, it, maybe even specific players, or Dame Lillard getting up there, 33, 34. We've all faced kind of how our games and roles maybe have to change at some point. Not saying that his does, but what advice would you overall give the Milwaukee Bucks at this point?
I think that, remember when I said we were just right there?
Yeah.
And they made changes? The Bucks, and John Horst is great. He's done some great things. So I'm not trying to. But the bottom line is, you don't know when you make changes if you're going to become better or not.
Right.
Right. And I think the advice I would give, and it's hard to be patient nowadays because of social media and the fans, and people expect so much, rightfully so. But every once in a while, you have to just say, okay, we're going to just hold with this group. We're not going to make any major trades to break them up. Obviously, if players get older, you have to consider all those factors. But, hell, old teams do go deep in the playoffs occasionally.
Yeah.
Don't they? Right. And so that my advice would be for the fans and for everyone, just when you have a good team, we've been there. You never know.
Right.
You never know if that was your only opportunity to win a championship, or then you make a trade. You win a championship, you play okay next year, but you need to shake things up. But when you start shaking things up, you just don't know the results of what's going to happen. So just be patient and get better players.
Bottom line.
It's still about players, man.
It's all about the players.
Facts.
Get some better players. That's my advice. I know they're working.
get some athletes in there. Anyway, look, man, I'm taking way too much of your time. Get off the bench. Get in the game. We appreciate you getting off the bench, getting in the game with Ear District, Marcus Johnson, Chris Johnson, fantastic voice. It's been a great, great afternoon, Sid. And we worked your overtime, so checks in the mail, bro.
you paid in full, my friend. Thank you.
All right, Sidney Moncrief. Right.
Thank you.
Marcus Johnson, Chris Johnson, the Here District. We will be back with more Here District next week.
This has been a Bucks Plus audio production.